for the Gathering Podcast.
I think being a chief people officer in a past life is a superpower that very few see. I think a lot of investors, I think the tech community as a whole is not used to seeing people go from chief people officer to founder. It's a very uncommon path.
Mm-hmm.
I could speculate on a lot of reasons why, but I actually think that it's a massive advantage to growing a tech company.
Yeah, I concur.
Some of your biggest problems as a founder are about people, whether it's investors, it's employees, it's customers. Understanding people's behavior is what chief people officers do, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's from recruitment, from culture, all these different angles. And as a founder, we're dealing with very similar issues, but you are redirecting that to your customers. You need to understand your customers' needs. What are they really looking for?
Mm-hmm.
Customers don't even know what they want half the time. Similar to people.
Listen to the people. Listen to the people. People. Oh, people in culture. Oh, yeah. It's time for the Gathering Podcast. It's time for the Gathering Podcast.
So Martin did mention a little bit of your career history to me before we jumped in here.
It's quite the sordid past.
Well, okay, so I know that there was a chunk of time you're at Barrowell.
Yep.
But you probably saw Barrowell grow in that period, right?
Yep. I joined them when they were about 20 people.
Okay.
Scaled them to 200, led a key acquisition that they made on the West Coast, went through a couple rounds of fundraising, was there for almost 5 years.
Wow.
So it was quite the journey.
So yeah. When it was 20 people, it was just you at the helm of the people and culture type stuff?
Yeah.
HR.
I was the first hire. I was it.
Was it exciting? Terrifying?
It was. It was all of it.
Yeah.
It was great. I have a lot of admiration. It was obviously very inspiring, which is why I was silly enough to think I could go out and do it on my own. No, which it was. It's what's inspired me to kind of found Coterie. So I have a huge amount of respect for them and just the whole ecosystem. And my career has been a lot of different twists and turns. I was a management consultant at Deloitte before getting into tech.
Okay.
I worked in pharma in New York. I have a master's degree in museology. So
wow, that's cool.
You stitch all that together, it's quite the patchwork.
Yeah.
Museology, you heard correctly. It is a real word.
Yes. Well, thank you for answering all those questions.
Study of museum management, essentially.
Yeah, hard left. I thought you were going to say music. I'm like,
No, museum. So I have an undergrad in art history, a master's in essentially museum management out of the UK.
Okay. That was the initial get into the museum
racket. It was, yeah. And I failed at that. I moved to New York after grad school and then failed at getting into the art world.
It's a tough world to get into in New York.
Yes, especially if you don't have a trust fund.
Right?
Yeah.
It's like you can't make money. You can get a job, but you won't make money.
I realize that you kind of max out at like 50, 60K working at MoMA or some of the big institutions.
Yeah.
It's, you start at 40K a year, and then miraculously, a lot of those people live in $3 to $5 million apartments in New York.
Honestly.
So those two things don't typically compute for me. So
when I lived in New York, a bunch of people I knew, most of the people I kept meeting, didn't understand how I lived in Harlem,
Right.
And that was in 2005. So it was still like gentrifying, but it was just about to. Like the Starbucks had just opened on like Malcolm X.
That.
And like kept getting rocks in the window.
Yeah.
And Fab Five Freddy was there making sure no one gets mad at him drinking his cappuccinos,
I lived in Williamsburg before it was cool when everybody would still say bridge and tunnel. I lived
there
totally.
In
like 2009 to 2011. It was a totally different time.
Totally different.
Everyone would say I was bridge and tunnel and nobody would come visit. And now I joke with all those friends because now they're living
the
in Williamsburg.
Exactly. It's the hot spot.
Yeah, it's the cool
like,
place
oh,
to be.
Oh, we never go into the city anymore. Uh-huh. Oh, the city? Oh, why would you go to the city?
All the good restaurants are here. Everything is better in Brooklyn.
Billy Berg.
Yeah. So, and then I kind of fell in love with tech actually through Deloitte.
That's my time
at Deloitte.
Please say that again.
Yeah. Deloitte at the time, during my time there, they had started a relationship with Communitech out of Waterloo.
Oh, cool.
And sponsored a big part of there. And so if you were in consulting, you had the opportunity to do kind of pro bono work with the companies that were kind of incubated at a Communitech. And so that's where I got my first exposure to the tech scene in Toronto.
That's phenomenal.
And that's when I decided I would make the switch. Make the switch, ditch the bitch.
And
you can edit that out.
Pharma, before that, what
were I was you... in New York and I was trying to get into the art world. Wasn't happening.
Yeah, so then how did that land you in pharma? What were you doing in pharma?
You want to know the real story?
Of course. Yeah.
The real story?
No, tell me a lie. Yeah. I mean, but I make, like, it, but make it good. Make the make lie it, better.
Make the lie better. The real story is pretty good. I'll just try to make it quick. Yeah. I was managing a restaurant in Greenpoint in Brooklyn.
Okay.
And a regular that would come in all the time, just, I guess, we clicked. And he worked in pharma and he thought I was wasting my time and energy managing a restaurant, which I was. But I was also hustling, trying to get into the art world.
Right.
Was what I was really doing. I'd always waitress and bartended through both my degrees. And yeah, he was the one that got me into pharma and thought I should go into sales and marketing and pharmaceutical world. And I decided I was tired of being poor, to be quite honest.
So you had a hand in the opioid crisis.
No.
This sounds like a movie I watched on Netflix recently.
I did not. No, I worked on a diabetes drug. To be very clear.
Okay. Okay.
But it was very eye-opening to the industry and made me realize very quickly that it was not for me.
Yeah.
That was the time that I realized I am very financially motivated. So I liked that piece of earning good money, but I'm also mission driven and those two things don't align for me personally in the pharma world. So
yeah, it's difficult.
I left and there was other personal reasons that I decided to move back to Canada and got my footing here.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
We were dunking on Canada for a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
But kudos to Communitech having that like Deloitte New York partnership that.
Well, nothing to do with New York, but yes.
But Deloitte, no, I'm surprised that Deloitte was willing to underwrite, you know, man hours.
Yeah.
Through their sponsorship. That's a very unique thing.
It's very smart. I have a lot of positive things to say about Deloitte. I know a lot of people shit all over consulting, but it's I think they do a lot that's quite innovative. It's very creative in their approach. And to be honest, it makes smart business sense because a lot of these companies do grow up to be big companies that can afford consulting services.
Right.
And as a founder, I'm sure all of us can potentially relate to this. You don't forget people who help you in the early days and you don't forget people that really...
And nobody helped me in the early days. The days are still young.
Yeah. Days are still young, but you still need the help.
Damn,
know?
Yes. Anyone listening to this, please help me.
Yeah, same.
Deloitte. Any way that you can.
Yeah, still open to help.
It's true. It's absolutely true that if there's any... I look at it like this. Like, these partnerships between educational institutions and corporations are really kind of potentially powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And it's up to the people normally in those roles really kind of like playing a balancing act to, you know, push their own agenda.
Yeah.
Often. And that's where a lot of virtue comes from. Because I played the same sort of role at IBM. I was like running their startup program across Canada, which is kind of an oxymoron, right?
Yeah.
Like, it was shank fest to just try and provide value. And, you know, I was given a remit from someone like high up, you know, like second to Ginni Rometty, the CEO, to, you know, use our resources in Canada to help startups at my own
discretion. Direct.
And so I started pulling people from like the UI UX teams that were doing great work for corporate clients saying, hey, why don't you give back on Fridays? Can you give me 2 hours? Yeah, no problem, man. Can you give me 4 hours? And then I get a manager's email.
Yeah.
Who's going to pay for those hours? And I'm like, I don't even, what do I have to? What are you talking about?
Pay?
I will not let you use my staff. And I'm like, okay, really?
Yeah.
Keep them on the farm. It's all good.
Yeah.
It's tough. It's tough.
Yeah.
And so then Okay, so you land yourself in startup world. You guys grow quick, and now you're at People and Culture.
Was my second startup.
Second startup. What was the first
startup? I worked at another startup that didn't take off. Worked at Borwell, loved it, and then had the idea for Coterie and decided to start my own business.
So how long has Coterie been a thing?
2 years.
And what is it?
Yeah. So it is a platform that helps sport professionals grow their own communities. So we're a SaaS product that helps them earn income while they're not on the course or court.
So I'm like a pro golfer.
Say golf or pickleball are the first two sports that we've...
But can you say those in the same sentence?
Golf and pickleball?
Yeah.
Oh, the two love each other.
They
There's
do?
There's a ton of crossover. Oh,
yeah. I guess both of them don't really like stress their knees much, right? Is that what it is?
Are you implying something? I was just at the PGA show in Orlando, and a huge section of the exhibition floor is dedicated to pickleball. There's two pickleball courts. There was...
It's a lifestyle thing. Yeah. They're complimentary, for sure.
There's a lot of complimentary.
My father-in-law, who's 70... Oh, forgive me.
Hope he doesn't watch this.
Yeah. I'll have to clip it and send it to him now.
Yeah.
Look at me fumbling on your age. I think
he's in his 70s.
Yeah, he's like 76, maybe. I think
he's okay with you not knowing his age.
Yeah.
Are you okay?
He doesn't know how to turn this on. It's okay. But like, no, he was, when we went for our annual family holiday in Mexico this last Christmas, he was delighted, like delighted that there was a pickleball court next to the pool because we had like a bunch of rainy days. And it was phenomenal. I started playing with him and random people. And
it's a super fun sport.
Yeah, and people to see how people to play pickleball.
Play pickleball, but people also love to dunk on it. To borrow Martin's term.
Yeah, no.
Well, because it looks like, it's like...
Don't they call the hits? Like when you hit a pickleball, it's called a dink or a donk?
Dink. A dink.
Oh, I didn't know
D-I-N-K.
That.
So that's one on the con... column of the pros and cons list.
But that makes
pickleball.
It more fun. What are you talking about? Yeah. You can just dink around all day.
You
I
can
love
dink
it.
Around.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's tons of companies that have popped up with the name Dink that are in the pickleball space.
Of course, right?
Yeah, the most popular newsletter.
But like, okay, so this is interesting. So whether they're pickleballers or golfers, they want to engage with their audience.
With their players or their community. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, their immediate community. So it's not about fans.
So it's not just about fans. It's about, you imagine a golf pro at a local course that has, you know, a strong email list of people who've either taken lessons from them, joined clinics that might be kind of adjacent to them. But how do you keep their attention? How do you monetize them? How do you make money off of them without just giving lessons, right? There's lots of ways to engage with those communities. And now more than ever, people need to maintain attention and keep top of mind. So we're really passionate about getting these sport professionals more opportunities to make money without just spending their time.
Mm-hmm.
My golf instructor's website is absolute trash.
Most of them are.
Sorry, Gary.
This is real.
You should tell Gary about Coterie.
I will. Yeah. I will. But like that, I'm processed. Yeah. Like this is how I'm figuring it out. But like,
it's interesting.
Nor should they. Like,
no. And this is it. This is where I talk to. Especially a lot of golf pros. We just announced a big partnership with the LPGA.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And I talk to golf pros all day long, and a lot of them struggle with this because what they're great at is the game.
Yeah.
It's the sport. Same with pickleball, same with any of these things. They've dedicated their lives, countless hours to being outside.
Pickleball.
Growing the game. Pickleball.
My parents love it. Yeah. No, my dad, it's his life now. Like, that will be his legacy, is like winning a trophy in pickleball.
Is he competing?
Yeah, he's trying to.
Good for him.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
And so they need people to help them with the business side. And that's where we come in.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
The part about community is interesting because every company seems to be going down this path. This is something that I'm familiar with from like the people group side, something Kasim's familiar with, like gathering people at his venues.
Yeah.
And so what you're building starts more with the digital side.
Yeah.
Which I think is interesting. What What have you learned so far in like the building out of this from like how it helps individuals connect digitally?
Well, I mean, first of all, we've learned a ton that the sport world is very underserved in terms of digital products, especially as it relates to community. There's a lot on the technical side. So I know, training, Martin, you play golf. Kazim, do you play?
I got time for golf.
Yeah. You got time for pickleball.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, no. I like golf, you know, but I don't get invited to play. This is the problem.
This is what we talk a lot about with underrepresented communities.
Thank you. I am underrepresented.
Yeah.
The last time that I played golf, I showed up for a tournament in Birkenstocks. And they let me on. I snuck on. And I played a fairly good game. And I hit a few under par as birdie.
It depends.
One under par?
Yeah. Yes.
One shot under par. I don't know what you call it.
Yes. I'm like, under par? Under par by what?
So I did okay in my Birkenstocks. And I was just ridiculed. And all those people that I know who play golf, now I suppose I know one more. Two more who can invite me onto the course.
Yeah. Yeah. I keep saying this. I think that'll be the thing. Yeah, that'll be the thing.
About it a lot. But we're very passionate about helping these professionals make more money, but also just growing the game. Mm. To your point, what does it matter if you play in Birkenstocks?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
If you're willing to pay and to get out and play, then, you know, there's a lot of discussion in especially golf, less in pickleball because it's a newer sport.
Right.
There is, you know, that one is a whole different beast. But in golf, there's a lot of discussion about how to grow the game and how to get more people and keep the attention. Golf grew a ton during the pandemic. They saw a huge surge. A lot of people either came to the game for the first time or got back into the game. A lot of the younger demographics, underrepresented people were getting out and playing because it was outdoors. It was safe.
Well, here, especially.
And it was one of the few things that was still open.
You weren't allowed to, like, you know. Yeah, it was crazy, right?
How do you maintain that attention? How do you keep people engaged in something now that the world has come back and people can go out and do all the same things they could before? And I can tell you, as not taking off the entrepreneur hat and putting on my mom hat, as a parent of three kids, it's very hard to get out and play a game.
Yeah, like how do you, I don't, man.
So if there was, you know, if there were courses that were putting in childcare or mini putt games that you could drop your kids off, right? There's a lot of discussion about how to modernize the game. And I'm really quite intrigued on all facets of.
Are you allowed to take kids with you golfing? Or do they get mad at you?
No, unless they're a player, like part of your foursome. And typically you're not
like
under
12. 6 years old? No.
12 and over is most course rules. Not all of them, but most of them.
It'd be cool to take my daughter golfing, man. Even if she just chills out and just cracks jokes.
Places don't have any form of bring your kids. And it's always been very VIP, exclusive, exclusionary. Mm-hmm. And so, but that's shifting in a lot of different ways. It's been interesting to see from a few different angles. One, you mentioned earlier that you are monetarily driven, but you're also mission driven.
Mm-hmm.
What's the mission driven piece for you with Coterie?
I mean, for me, it's all about getting more people into the game. And the more we can help professionals grow their individual businesses, the more that gets more people into the game, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So imagine you, Martin, are a golf pro. The more I can help you make money, that means the more you're growing your game, and you're the golf pro. I'm not a golf pro, right? I came to golf later in life, picked up pickleball 4 years ago, something, you know, but coming into these sports, you start to see how much it can bring people together. And it's not just about the sport. It's about that community piece.
Mm-hmm.
I've met great people professionally on the golf course that I never would have. The first time I picked up a golf club was when I was working at Deloitte. Because I knew that so much business happens on the golf course. And as a woman, I stand out. I'm very memorable because you can count on one hand
how many
of us say yes to golf tournaments.
Yeah.
And that's starting to change a little bit. But there still is a massive underrepresentation. I was at a tournament in September in the tech community. There's 120 players. And there was 12 of us.
Yeah.
There were 12 women that played.
Like across the board with the tech community in general, right? It's so...
And then the dinner reception, more women turned up.
No
but
way.
But they didn't come to the... They just didn't play the round of golf and then came to the dinner reception.
Hmm. Oh, so, I let Chet do these things. Yeah.
But I think as a woman, you actually have a... Not just... I shouldn't just say woman because it's also extremely white.
Yeah.
Yeah. Golf? Golf is super golf, white, man.
Golf is so this white.
This is shocking.
Yeah. Yeah, and so as any kind of like underrepresented person, you stand out. And I think a lot of people tend to just self-select out instead of flipping their perspective right. and saying, this is a great advantage that you're memorable, that people are going to say, hey, I think I saw you at that golf event. Were you there?
Yeah, like being an early adopter of Twitter, for example, if you just put in the work when it first came out, oh, look at you. You've got all these followers. You put in and people. So there's like this benefit of just having shown up on a regular basis and
compounding interest, my friend. Basic. Yeah.
But so, okay. So tell us a little bit about this like idea of how your platform helps taking lessons from the kind of like what you might have learned growing teams in a corporate reality, how professional athletes can grow their team. Like, is there a corollary directly there, or is it just something that where inspiration from your history came in?
I mean, it's a bit of both, but I would say that I think being a chief people officer in a past life is a superpower that very few see. I think a lot of investors, I think the tech community as a whole is not used to seeing people go from chief people officer to founder. It's a very uncommon path.
Mm-hmm.
I could speculate on a lot of reasons why, but I actually think that it's a massive advantage to growing a tech company.
Yeah, I concur.
Some of your biggest problems as a founder are about people, whether it's investors, it's employees, it's customers. Understanding people's behavior is what chief people officers do, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's from recruitment, from culture, all these different angles. And as a founder, we're dealing with very similar issues, but you are redirecting that to your customers. You need to understand your customers' needs. What are they really looking for?
Mm-hmm.
Customers don't even know what they want half the time. Similar to people where they say that, you know, they want snacks and that's not the problem you're trying to solve for, right? Like,
oh, it's snacks.
Yeah.
We that all hurts. Just want snacks.
Everyone all wants the time. Catered lunches.
You think you want
catered lunches, but you don't. So it's my point such is point. That if you are a strategic people leader and people executive especially, and you've been used to sitting at the table having the tough conversations about the business as a whole, you're very well positioned, in my perspective, to be a founder.
Because
you start to understand your customers' needs and you're constantly putting the people first, whether that's your investors, your employees, and you realize the power that that can bring to your business.
Well, especially if your intent is to actually build a business.
Right? What else are founders intending to build?
Fatter bank accounts.
Right.
Directly. You know, it's about the balance that Marty called out that, you know, a lot of people don't have, you know. I don't know. I was surprised by this. I might sound old and jaded, right? When our hair starts going gray, just talk shit about young people. But like,
hey, my hair started going gray when I was a young person.
There you go. I've been talking shit about people since I was 24. Yeah.
Before it was cool.
I was talking shit about myself since I can remember.
But like, what I meant was in the last, I think it's in the last, accelerated in the last five, well, the pandemic threw things off. Let's call it the last decade. This kind of like the bro culture in this false Silicon Valley emulation mode that Canadian founders and especially first-time founders have had with the easy access to pre-seed, seed, early-stage capital has been very interesting to watch, especially from the sidelines, to see how people are not necessarily in software, right? And then we've got this AI thing that's changed the world in the last few years.
But AI like, thing.
Right? But like before AI.
Keep an eye on that.
Oh my God. Before AI, it was like You actually had to hire people to make the software, and you're not concerned about redundancy, or at least your investors aren't. So you're saying, okay, like, this thing's going to have legs and it's going to become a unicorn, right? And it's going to be amazing, man. And you're taking OPM, right? And you're deploying it. It's like, it's a burn fest, and it's burn over earn, right? It's burn over earn. And a lot of the majority, in fact, of portfolio don't necessarily, typically venture-backed portfolios in Canada don't necessarily have a clear path to, like,
those days are gone, though.
Well, no, they're gone in the sense that if you talk to a VC, they're going to be like, I want to see a clear path to, like, profit scale. Well, yeah, we hope profitability. It should be profit scale. It shouldn't even just be profitability. It should be profit scale. But, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you just went through the raise mode. So
yeah, we raised a small pre-seed.
So
nice, friends and family kind of thing, or institutional?
No, mostly like angels.
Angels.
Yeah. So you're
in the U.S.
Your perspective on what the temperature is like right now is very much like, it's not even scale of profitability; it's actual profitability. Like, if you can't.
I mean, I think it's constantly changing, and it depends where you talk. There's always a higher risk appetite in the U.S. I found a lot more success with U.S. angel investors. Love our Canadian angel investors, but most of them, you know, when you've scaled and operated a business, you have a network, you have a track record, right? So I was very fortunate in that I knew a lot of founders and CEOs from my time with Borrowell, and I'm very grateful to that. But then going to that next layer was a lot more challenging for me in Canada, and I found a lot more success going to the US, especially with the type of business I'm trying to build. I think the scale of the sport world in the US is just so much more, you know, I mean, I can quote the numbers, but our population is, you know, the entire country is the size of Florida. Yeah. So when you look at that, it just doesn't compare and compute for a lot of Canadian investors our interest is not to start in Canada. Like, we've started the business in the US. That's where our customers are. That's where we look to grow. That's the market we want to dominate.
When you guys are kind of like communicating with the customer base, with athletes, what are the values of community that you think they all connect with?
I mean, number one is growing the game. I think, you know, everyone wants to grow the game and for the game to be more inclusive. And I think, obviously, there's an economic factor to that. The more we grow it, the more money is on the table. Right. The more we get people to be interested and grow the game, there's more economic upside for everybody involved, whether that's suppliers, courses, the pros themselves. Everybody wins. But, you know, there's a lot around this idea of connectedness. Everybody seems to be very interested, similar to community being a bit of a buzzword. So is longevity, and people are very interested about not just how long we live, but the quality of life that we have. And I think there has been a lot more attention given in the last couple of years to this idea that loneliness kills.
Mm-hmm.
And
hot topic in the States.
Yeah. And how do we start to, you know, swing the pendulum a bit the other way? We've swung it so far towards tech, which has created a disconnect. And in the U.S., for one of the first times in modern history, you know, lifespans are reducing. You know, people are dying younger than they have in the past years. And there's a lot of reasons that kind of tend to start to point towards that could be related to social connections and a lack of connectedness.
Oh, yeah. Lifestyle factors for sure. Diet, lack of connectivity,
I feel really passionate that sport hits on all of that. Right? It's
absolutely
increasing mobility. It's increasing your social connectedness. It's getting you outside, right? Just certain elements of getting more vitamin D, right? Getting a bit more sun and exposure. So there's a lot of things that we think sport really can help. And it doesn't have to be about the technical or the competitive aspects. It can be social. And repositioning why people play includes more people.
Mm. I just went down a rabbit hole of, do you add sort of a activity tracker to like the app for the individuals where it's like, oh, just to keep them engaged.
Yeah, we have a number of different kind of gamifications in app, less around like specific activity and more around kind of engagement, because we're focused on the community piece and trying to think about sport differently.
Yeah.
Right? Thinking about it as a community builder, as a way for you to, instead of, I would love in the future world, instead of saying go for coffee, go for a game of pickleball.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
Right?
I used to do that with tennis. I used to invite people for a tennis game all the time.
And there are certain games that are more conducive to that because they're shorter. And that's why I said pickleball and not golf. Like, you're not going to go for a 4-hour coffee all the time. People don't necessarily have that kind of time.
Yeah.
You know, or that you're going to play 18 holes. And that's the reason you and I have probably struggled to do it between having young kids and everything. Taking a half day is no joke. But pickleball is on the complete other side of that. And it's very inclusive in suburban America. People have their driveways as a pickleball court.
Yeah.
And, you know, can hop out, play a game in 20 minutes and be back on Zoom.
20 minutes is long, man. I just challenge people to thumb wars.
Right.
Like, that's my sport.
Bring back the old-fashioned arm wrestle.
Right.
An arm wrestle.
I'll just lose really quickly and then we can talk business. Come on. Yeah. No, it's catching on like wildfire, right? Like pickleball.
All of it is. But I was saying to Martin, too, that for me, you also learn a lot about people playing games with them.
Yeah,
and you learn a lot about people's personalities, how they lose, how competitive they are, how they talk to themselves, how hard on themselves they are, right? Take a bad shot. Are you going to beat yourself up for the next three holes, or are you going to just brush it off and move on?
Yeah. To double click on that further, the joke / half serious, like the half joke I made was if we could have pickleball as a part of the interview process.
Oh, and like you're the hiring manager, like,
please. Yeah, this is what Mark was talking about before.
This is ridiculous. But
yeah, and you'd get tons. I mean, you told me nobody listens to the podcast, but if there's people that do, I would love to hear. I'm sure people in the comments would blow up about this idea that it's not inclusive to play sport, right?
Yeah.
In an interview process.
Well, like if you
people have, leaders, we've heard it all.
Yeah.
But I do think there's something to it.
Yeah.
Whether you've played or not, it doesn't matter. It's about how you handle the game. It's like any assessment, right? It's not about the results. It's about how you deal with challenges, how you collaborate, right? If you're playing in doubles, like playing in doubles pickleball is part of your interview.
It would be huge.
Quite hilarious.
It would be hilarious.
Throw them in with the team, right? Yeah.
Insightful, I think.
Yeah, if a guy goes Mac and roll on everyone, it's done.
Yeah.
Sorry. We'll call you back never. But
here's where it all fell apart.
Right? Yeah.
Just record the pickleball game. Like,
for you, though, what was the catalyst for going this route of becoming a founder? I missed it in the career history. Was it people and culture? Role at Borrowell, because it's two W's. Borrowell,
two W's.
It's funny that you can't say it, considering it's quite close to Startwell.
Hard consonant on a T, right? Startwell. It ends, but like Borrowell, it's like too many W's. My lips are fat, man.
Okay.
So, but anyway,
It was my time there.
Yeah.
That I started to come back into sport myself. I read a very fascinating book called Together by Vivek Murphy. I'm not sure if you guys have read it.
No.
Highly recommend it. All about this concept of loneliness and about longevity. He's the Surgeon General in the U.S.
Yep.
And does a fantastic job of weaving storytelling with the data around how our lack of connectedness is really impacting the duration and the quality of life that we live. The doom scrolling is what I always call it.
Yeah, it's like, we're all connected apart.
Yeah, and like the convenience of it is misleading.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, and I was just saying, and then I got really quite obsessed around more the mission and the purpose of getting more active myself and caring more about this idea of connectedness, but wellness and just being more physically active, having young kids and focused 150% on my career for, 12 plus years. I was a real and I obviously still am as a founder, but how do I weave in this idea of, you know, living a more intentional life? And I think that as a woman and doing a lot of user research, especially with underrepresented groups and why they maybe shy away from sport, is so much about its positioning and people having perceptions that it's hyper competitive, it's overly technical, it's not for me, it's not welcoming, it's not where I belong. And I really thought there was there's a great opportunity, and I obviously still believe that, like, very passionately, that this, like, Venn diagram of bringing together kind of sport, wellness, and in a professional context, like, people can really see that there's so much value to be had here.
Yeah.
And that people can, you know, be helping themselves from a health perspective, but they can be networking and they can stay active.
It's so interesting because, you know, like, in this series, we're now in the second season of the Gathering Podcast. But, like, many of the conversations we've had on and off mic have been to do with people, their career stories coming into people in culture roles and HR roles, right? And we haven't been talking to too many people. So I've enjoyed this conversation to speak to
people
someone
who have left it.
Well, yeah, who came into it and left it, you know? It's not like...
I don't see it as leaving. I think...
Yeah. Because you're still doing community stuff.
But not only community, I just feel so passionately that founders, so much of what you deal with is to do with people.
Oh, yeah.
And kind of people problems, people issues, right? Whether you want to call it a problem or just directly related to people.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I really don't think I've left it as much as it's evolved. And now in the role of CEO and founder, you know, that is a key part, but now my stakeholder group is just different. It's, yes, it's part employees, but it's investors, it's my customers, it's industry leaders, and those are all still valuable.
Yeah, it's about relationships, right? Yeah. Managing relationships and encouraging people, various stakeholders, to stay kind of engaged but motivated in their own role for whatever you need and for theirs. Yeah.
If, what were you saying? If you put on your VP CPO hat, you're leader of people at an organization, and you're not the person that is building what you're building now, but you hear about it. Are you looking to eventually, because there's an interesting cross section of the thing that companies want or executives want is for people to feel more engaged.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like this belonging piece. You can see where I'm going.
Yes.
And so I'm curious about that aspect, because there's the wellness piece, which is also something that HR teams are responsible for. There's the connectivity between teams that is unique and, you know, outside of, like we talked on a previous episode, of getting out of your space, getting out of like the four walls that the company operates within, so you can think creatively about new ideas or bridge connections. Coterie seems to be, I'd be curious to know, like, is that on the roadmap? Is that something you want to build towards, or is it a little bit off? Is it sort of like it would be a nice to have?
Yeah, it's interesting given the macroeconomic environment right now. I think if we were in a different time, that might have been the direction. And maybe exactly. If it was in 2020, it might have been the direction that Coterie would evolve to, especially given that we did start originally as a B2C platform to help connect women through sport on golf and pickleball. And we still have that side of the platform running, but we've spun out and started this B2B product that has just gotten faster traction. And, you know, we really enjoy, and it furthers along the mission. And we know that that will feed the B2C platform as well in the long term. And we're here to build a big, meaningful business. So, yes. And like in the future world, is there some point where this becomes, you know, a way for teams and to build wellness? Yes. But I don't know what you're hearing, but I've heard a lot in the space that budgets aren't what they used to be.
Oh, yeah.
While companies are saying that they're focused on connectedness and wellness, that's not as much. And it's the market has shifted back to being a bit more of an employer market and not the employee market.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's not the right time for us to be focused on that.
That makes sense. But the opportunity, should if and when things turn around.
Yeah.
There is that interesting play of
sport
like,
in the corporate getting, context.
Because yeah. it happens organically, right? You know, someone will start a golf channel in Slack and then, you know, mm-hmm. but it again, it's very bro-y. It's the sales yep. team, it's the executives. Totally. And then there become
it's true.
The numbers. Yeah, look at the numbers. So it is what it is. But then if there's another way to go about it, and there's a platform to kind of promote it in a way that gets everybody mm-hmm. versus like the sales team doesn't need to bond.
Yep.
The executives don't like, yes, they do, but in different ways, but the whole mm-hmm. organization would benefit from like going back to the point of like the crazy idea of doing an interview and having it, but like just seeing how other people work together over a game of pickleball.
Mm-hmm.
My parents are going to love this episode.
pickleball.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's how we kind of started too, right? We have a ton of content. We have creators, like we have vetted professionals on the golf and pickleball side that have created custom content for us to help, you know, educate people, inform people. And then we have we've leveraged a lot of AI in the platform to help match people off a number of different criterias. Suggest locations to play at, all these types of things. So it's not that far-fetched and far-reaching for us to think about that. I think there's a lot of opportunity for organizations to keep people way more engaged, but also help to get more business, quite mm-hmm. frankly, too. The more you encourage people to be thinking about themselves as a full person when they're in the office building or outside, I think the more you build connections and the more you get people to be thinking about your business all the time. And that includes the golf course and the pickleball court.
Totally.
Do you have two sections of users? Like you've got the pros that are...
That's the B2B product.
Yeah. And then you've got the...
The B2C product.
The B2C
well.
Side mm-hmm. as well. Interesting.
Which is focused on women yeah. today. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
two
very different communities, but all kind of feeding similar purpose, right? About kind of getting people more into the game, getting more access, getting more awareness.
It's super interesting because in North America, this might be a global phenomenon, but like there's this kind of dichotomy between the player and the fan, you know, and I think it's because of the commercialization of sport, but like that naturally precludes people from assuming that they can kind of be they can flip and they can be a professional in some way. Not that they need to be, but that they could be a player.
Yeah. Because
like takes so much effort to be a player.
Right.
And they're like, maybe that's not me, you know, but it's okay. I'll just like.
But it kind of goes back to your first point. What you opened with was yeah. I never get invited.
Right.
So many people say that. I would go out. Oh, I would play golf if somebody invited me out.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'd try pickleball if somebody invited me. You know, there's both sides of the coin. Why do you need to be invited? Like, start your own game
yeah.
is what I say to people.
Yeah.
Or ask people to say, hey, have you ever played? Great. I want to invite you to come teach me, you know, or whatever it might be. And then the other side is, yeah, if you play, like, just invite people more.
So many people don't know what pickleball is. I didn't know what pickleball is.
I think that's more in Canada.
Yeah, sure.
We are always...
Sure. Yeah.
A couple years behind.
Right. Fastest growing sport in North America.
For 3 years in a row.
Yeah. So the other thing against golf is that it is like financially prohibitive. So yeah, if you expensive. Have underrepresented yeah. Folks trying to get into the sport, pickleball seems to be the way to go.
For sure.
If you're in.
It's like, cheaper on time and money.
Time and money, right? So that makes sense that you would. There's also, it makes sense to have golf as well. Are you looking at other sports to add
to the platform?
Yeah.
Yes and no, not in the short term.
Yeah.
We know there's a lot of opportunity to grow and on those two. And we're also very passionate. We have some inroads there. So that's a clear line, but obviously in the future, yes. And that's why we started with two. We wanted to be really clear that we're not a single sport SaaS platform, right? We're not intended just for one sport. We're not building this in a way that only works for golf
yeah.
or only works for pickleball. There's a lot of sports and growth out there that we think could be really interesting.
So the aspect of like with Startwell, you've been very intentional about designing the experience. So that when somebody shows up, the place sells itself. And it does when you know, this is the most legit podcast studio I've been in. And it's like, ooh, there's a sheen to it, so to speak. There's an excitement. There's like, you want to tell people about it.
Right.
For me, on the people group side, like the experience of a member of someone joining is important. And like those first like moments, you have the same thing with your place. Now, like, how are you designing the experience? Because how are you designing the experience so that the people that do join or do follow end up like, what are your thoughts in like creating that community? Because it doesn't just happen, right? There's like an intimidating factor.
Do you mean like, okay, a digital platform can connect people, but once they're connected, they need encouragement to be related to each other.
How do you invite people onto the dance floor, right? There's a dance party. And everybody knows about it.
And we have... So we have a number of different ways. We give like a toolbox to the pro to help them onboard their community. So that gives them suggestions of how to engage, whether that's through email and posts and different recognition, a number of different ways that we really rely on the professional to do part of that, to bring in their, they're bringing in their community, right? And then as we've scaled, we've started our own sub-community of pros that use the Coterie platform, and how do we recognize them and create our own Coterie community of people who use it. So there's a couple different ways, but we've been very fortunate with this partnership with the LPGA, and we're working with a couple of other associations that helps gives us the inroads to these professionals, and not only kind of builds the top of funnel sales for us, but also gives a sense of community, right? These people pay a lot of money for their membership association fees to be part of, whether it's the LPGA, the PGA, you know, there's pickleball associations, recently an amalgamation, I'm sure your father knows a lot about, in the US. And, you know, like there's strong community foothold with these associations that we feel really strongly is a great alignment from a values perspective on helping us to kind of build that sense of community too. Okay. Yeah. Okay. As a young company, it's always hard to build your brand, right, and build your community when people don't know you. And especially for us being female founders based in Canada, when we're building a business in the US, you know, there's a lot. I'm half American and I lived there, but I'm not physically there day to day. I end up having to travel a fair bit as well. But I'm learning a ton too along the way.
A little bit of a pivot, but it's still for the overall conversation. But we talked about how you started out in the people and culture space, and now you're into the founder space and the startup entrepreneur side. For the people that are listening, that are in people ops, that have this itch to build something eventually, curious to get what your advice to them would be, curious to get your advice to them to follow in your footsteps, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, even going back before I answer the actual question, I think a difference with me too is that I was never a real people person, right? I came from management consulting. I didn't kind of grow up and get my HR certification and check all the boxes in a traditional sense.
Yeah.
I was a generalist in business first before kind of going deep into the people space. So I've always been very comfortable making big jumps, right? Because I'm always very careful about giving out advice, because I think everybody has to follow what they have to follow what works for them, because you might not have the risk appetite. I always like to be really honest with people that it is hard. However hard you think it is, it's going to be 10 times harder.
Yeah,
it is a constant path of difficulty.
Yeah, you're literally choosing the most difficult path possible. If you want something easy, comfortable, stable, reliable, and consistent,
get fired every couple quarters and keep getting a new job.
And then keep applying to another job with somebody that you used to work at the previous company.
Exactly.
Just, I think it's not to say, like, don't do it. I mean, the other side is, if you're going to do it, I say you have to kind of make the leap. And there's no other advice except like just do it. Just get out and do it and iterate. I mean, would I do things differently for myself? Probably, you know, there's always good lessons learned along the way. But I think there's small ways you can start earlier. Mm-hmm. I probably would have started even earlier in life, mm-hmm. having two little kids and then having, you know, I started the company in January of 2022 and I gave birth to my third May 1st. So I had two kids in 1 year, essentially. I had a company baby and a real baby within the same, 6 months. So I wouldn't do that again.
That's fair.
But I think the advice is to just get out and start, but you have to realize what your risk tolerance is.
But also, don't you think there's this kind of misconception amongst career employees that are kind of assuming that another job is self-employment. That's the way, and there's no fault on anyone's head to think of it that way, because if that's the way that you see the world, everyone is an employee, then you don't understand what it means to not be an employee. Mm-hmm. And it's about shedding comfort and embracing risk, sure, but it's also about having the means of self-propulsion.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of motivation.
Yeah, right? All of it.
And everything's on you,
mm-hmm.
but it's also within your own head.
Yeah.
In terms of how you rule set, goal set, success, pat on the back set. Like, how do you feed your soul while you're, putting things in the world?
Yeah.
And deal with hardships along the way, of course, and mm-hmm. rejection, but also deal with success. And it's interesting because I know you've just started on this path, right? But you mentioned you just dropped it. You got the LPGA on board and stuff. So that's good. Those are little wins, right? That like mm-hmm. you have access to customers now,
Yeah.
But it's very difficult to even explain to someone thinking about becoming an entrepreneur as such or launching a venture that you rarely even have time to see any milestones of success as that. When do you celebrate? How is it worth celebrating when you still got bills to pay? It's like, yeah, this is awesome, but now we got more expenses.
I feel attacked.
No, sorry.
Because we just celebrated her a lot. No.
I mean, listen, I think it depends on your personality. Anyone who's worked with me knows I've never been great at celebrating the wins. When I was an executive, I wasn't great at it. And that's very odd for a former chief people officer to say. I was like, yeah, here's your glass of champagne. Like, let's get back to work. Like, right. Who cares?
Yeah,
it's like we got shit to do. We got other stuff to do. We have bigger milestones to hit.
It's Deloitte talking.
Yeah. And I think it is kind of, my like being bred in this, like, it's just never enough environment is also very much in line with a founder's mentality, because if you celebrate the wins too much, the hits are so low. If the highs are highs, the lows are lower. So for me, it's always been like, well, let's just kind of try to keep us, even keel as we can.
Yeah, keep it going.
Because you got to just keep on chugging on.
Yeah, and you have to enjoy that kind of like ever presence, right? It's really important as an entrepreneur to just be able to be in the moment. And
what's that like?
Right? No, and revel in that. I mean, I think that's the only
thing
that you can do.
Tell me what that feels like. No.
But yeah, people ask that question.
Let's all hold hands and just be in the moment.
What?
What?
Yeah.
It's very interesting. People, especially I talk to, by virtue of my wife being a doctor, I in the last decade have met many professionals and talked to professionals a lot. Otherwise, it wouldn't happen. But I find it very interesting, that mindset of particularly like if you're a lawyer, doctor, accountant,
business executive.
Well, even not necessarily within that same ilk, but like if you've got like a functional job and you're on a career track that's preset, right, with a glass ceiling, but it's your lifestyle because it's very finite.
Yeah.
What we're talking about, the entrepreneurial path is the opposite. It's the inversion of that.
And the
cultures don't even.
Yeah.
I can't explain anything to anyone,
Yeah. No. And
it's very interesting.
I think you're somebody who likes to innovate or create or not. And like, the world needs both. Mm. That's the other thing. I think 100%. We've kind of swung to this glamorizing entrepreneurship and founder life.
Have we?
But
I hope we've
externally,
been.
Externally, you don't think
so? Okay. Oh, no, I'm externally. Not saying, conversationally.
Popular culture.
No, I think public culture is more what I'm talking about, that we've externally put it on a bit of a pedestal. And
the new deities, right?
Until you're in it, you don't really realize that, you know, it's obviously not how life is. I mean, if you've joined an early stage company, you probably have a lot of insight. Mm-hmm. You have a little bit of the insight.
An appetizer to the main course. The buffet that is entrepreneurship.
Yeah. But I've always liked launching things and doing different ventures. I mean, I launched my own podcast this year. And, you know, I've committed to kind of continuing to launch things, and you have to be okay with some things are going to hit and some things won't.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.